Tamar and Judah.
And then he asked the men of her place, saying, Where is the harlot that was at Eniam by the wayside? And they said, There hath been no harlot here. Genesis 38, verse 21.
Tamar reclined against the trunk of an ancient olive tree at a fork in the road near the village gate. Her face was artfully veiled, and between her breasts she wore a tiny cloth sack of balsam and myrrh that she had cadged from one of the village women. Beneath her robe of blue cotton, the afternoon heat began to raise a fine sweat on her skin. A scent of myrrh, of lemons and oranges, of the private places of her body, suffused her garment like a perfume. She watched the road with half-closed eyes and waited for the man called Judah. She had heard that he was on his way to the festival at Timnah, and she counted on catching his eye as he passed by. If her plan worked, he would not recognize Tamar as his own widowed daughter-in-law. Instead, Judah would take her for a common whore, and more than that, his passion would be aroused and he would seek her favors in the nearby olive grove. On that, Tamar thought to herself, everything now depended. Judah had wandered into the district a few years ago, a lone Israelite among the native people of Canaan. He was seeking to put himself at a distance from his stern father, an Israelite chieftain called Jacob, and a gaggle of brothers who competed for the old man's favor. The prospect of settling as a stranger among the Canaanites was more agreeable to Judah than staying in the household of his father. Jacob's favorite son, Joseph, had been set upon and killed by some wild beast while tending the old man's flock, or so the brothers had told Jacob when they returned from the distant hills with Jacob's blood-stained robe. The brothers consoled their father and competed with each other in displaying their grief, but they watched each other with cautious eyes. Would one of them tell the grieving father what had really happened in the place where Joseph disappeared? So Judah decamped from his father's place in the hill country near Hebron and moved into the lowlands where the Canaanites tended their fields and their flocks. Near the Canaanite village of Adullam, Judah and a few of his men pitched their tents in a meadow that belonged to a villager named Hira. When Hira and his men approached the Israelite squatters, Judah hailed them with one hand raised in greeting and the other hand on his short sword that he wore on his hip. As it turned out, Hira did not seek to drive Judah and his band of Israelites out of the meadow. Indeed, he saw a chance to profit by the encounter. Like all newcomers, Hira calculated, they would be willing seekers of advice and buyers of lands and goods. So Hira befriended the stranger and offered to sell him houses and fields and livestock, and Judah was soon the master of his own estate, a plot of open land, an orchard of lemon and orange trees, a flock of sheep, and another of goats. Judah built a house, dug a well, raised a wall of rough stone to mark the boundaries of his land. The fields were planted with wheat, and the flocks were allowed to graze in the distant wadis. Before long, a few of Judah's kinfolk heard of his good fortune, and their tents began to blossom like wildflowers around the compound. Judah boldly married a Canaanite woman, the daughter of a neighboring landowner named Shua. And Judah's wife, a shy, soft-spoken woman known as Bat-Shua, daughter of Shua, gave him three sons. Soon enough, Judah was a chieftain in his own domain, surrounded by dutiful Israelites who sought his favor and protection even as they had once attended on Jacob. Judah sent gifts to his father's house at Hebron to demonstrate his wealth. A Canaanite weaving, a vessel of worked silver, a ram or a ewe. But Judah preferred to stay within his own walls. He did not want to face his father with the burden of his guilty knowledge about the fate of Joseph, a slave in Egypt. Or perhaps, more likely, dead. As time passed, Judah continued to rely on Hira's knowledge of the curious dialect spoken by the locals and his willingness to offer advice on their ways in everything from sheep shearing to well drilling. But Judah learned that he was still at the mercy of the Israelite graybeards who had attached themselves to his compound and constantly reminded him of his duties as the chieftain of his own clan. "The law decrees," was their tiresome refrain, and they were constantly nudging him in one direction or another. "The worship of Baal is an abomination in the eyes of the Lord," the elders insisted. And so Judah forbade the Canaanites who lived among them as servants and shepherds to sacrifice to their own gods. "The Canaanites are fornicators who seduce our young men and turn our young women into whores," they cried. And Judah forbade the Israelites to visit the temple prostitutes who offered their bodies as altars for the worship of Astarte, the goddess of fertility, in the nearby Canaanite towns. "Your firstborn must marry so that the clan will survive into yet another generation," the old men carped, reminding Judah that a grandson was all the more crucial because his own wife had ceased giving him sons. And so Judah cast about for a wife for his eldest son, the one called Ur. Judah mentioned the matter to Hira, of course, and soon his old friend appeared at Judah's door with a match to propose. "I have found a suitable wife for your firstborn son," Hira said, "a flower of Canaan, and so your son may be assured of a willing woman with a fertile womb." "Perhaps I should send back to my father's house for a woman of our own people," Judah mused. "That's what the old men say." "Your father's spies," Hira hissed, saying out loud what Judah had always suspected. "If you allow your father to pick a wife for your son, you will put a spy in his bed. Far better you should choose Tamar."
"Tamar?" asked Judah. The name meant date palm.
And Judah was reminded of the oasis where he and his brothers had struck a bargain with the caravanners who carried Joseph off to Egypt. "Tamar is the woman I have found to be the bride of your firstborn," Hira explained. "Her name suits her. She flowers even in the desert, and she will bear the sweetest of fruit." From the day she arrived at the compound, Tamar was not like the Israelite women among whom she suddenly found herself as the bride of Judah's eldest son. The other young women fell silent when Judah passed the women's tent. Drawing their veils about their faces, they followed him with their eyes. They fell into chatter and giggles when he was out of earshot. Tamar, by contrast, ignored the chieftain, or seemed to, and continued to speak in a voice that was somehow too loud, too strong. Although a married woman, she was not careful about her veil and boldly allowed her father-in-law to see her uncovered face. Sometimes she actually smiled or even laughed in the presence of the menfolk. Some of the young women were outraged by Tamar. Some secretly admired her audacity. But if Judah noticed that his daughter-in-law was bolder than the rest, indeed, if Judah noticed the dark-eyed young woman at all, he gave no sign of it. Not long after her marriage to Ur, however, Tamar turned into an object of pity rather than outrage in the eyes of the women. As the wife of Ur, who was destined to become the chieftain in his own time, she was to be the mother of many powerful sons. But one day her husband left the compound on some errand that no one bothered to explain to Tamar, and he never came back. Tamar, the Canaanite flower, found herself a childless widow among the Israelites. No one who actually knew the fate of Judah's firstborn son ever talked about it. Judah himself was silent on the subject, but there was a hint of scandal in the strange disappearance. "He was wicked in the sight of the Lord," was all that the old men were willing to say. "And the Lord slew him." "As if that explained everything," the Israelites complained to one another. "Exactly what sin did Ur commit to bring down God's wrath upon him? Did he sacrifice to the Canaanite gods and go up in flames along with the sacrificial lamb? Or, more likely, was he discovered in a bed where he did not belong? And did he then suffer the wrath of a vengeful father or husband?" Tamar, who knew all too well that her husband did not burn very hot in bed, did not think much of either explanation. Perhaps, she thought to herself, he fell under a blow from one of the sullen young men of Canaan who did not share Hira's affection for the strangers among them. Judah called Tamar into his presence only once after Ur's death. She noted that her father-in-law never actually looked at her, averting his eyes as if out of embarrassment. But the three old men who hovered behind his chair studied her with brazen curiosity and open disdain. "You will not be forgotten," Judah announced brusquely. "My second-born son will do what he is obliged to do." "I am sorry, father," she said, "but I do not understand."
"Quiet, girl," one of the old men hissed. "Of course you do not understand, poor benighted heathen that you are," another of the old men began. "The law decrees."
Now, the third old man interrupted, noisily clearing his throat and speaking in a rumbling drone that sounded like distant thunder to Tamar. "Onan will come unto you in your tent, and lie with you, and perform the duty of a husband's brother," the graybeard said, using his stilted Hebrew phrases of the law to describe the fate that awaited the widowed Tamar. "Though you will never marry Onan, the child of your union with him will be regarded as the true son of your dead husband, and the child will take the name of your dead husband and his inheritance too."
"And so," said the first old man in a voice that sounded almost cheerful by comparison, "you may remain among us and raise the child."
"Enough," Judah said, allowing himself one oblique glance at her veiled face. "You may go, daughter." The old men watched as Tamar backed out of the house and then put their heads together behind Judah's back. "Now let us pray," one of them intoned, "that the second-born is more fruitful than the first-born."
"For her sake," another one said, "as well as for ours."
Onan glowered at Tamar from the shadows of the tent where his father had delivered him. Freshly bathed, anointed with fragrant oil, and draped in bridal robes, she now reclined on a mound of weavings on the floor, the very same bedding on which she had once submitted to the attentions of his older brother. "Go to her," Judah had instructed his second-born, "and take your brother's place between her legs." And when Onan grimaced at the suggestion, Judah laughed out loud. "It won't be so bad, I promise you." Now, as Onan hesitated, he noticed that his brother's robe, familiar and haunting, still hung from one of the ropes of the tent.
"Are you ready?" he croaked.
Tamar nodded at him, but did not speak.
"Well," he said, lingering near the opening of the tent, "I am not."
Tamar was lovely enough. Onan had not failed to notice the glittering dark eyes above her veil even when Ur was alive, and the thought of bedding his brother's widow was tantalizing precisely because it would have been forbidden under any other circumstances. But Judah had explained the solemn consequences of a moment of pleasure with Tamar, and Onan could not rid himself of the thought that he was about to do himself out of his own good fortune. The death of his older brother had been a stroke of luck, Onan had thought at first. Ur had been so arrogant, so lazy, always lording it over his brother, simply because he had been fortunate enough to be born first. Now Ur was dead, and it was Onan who stood to inherit Judah's lands and houses and flocks as the eldest son. He would be the next chieftain, and Judah's place would someday be his own. Unless, that is, Onan performed his duty in Tamar's tent and succeeded in impregnating Tamar with a son. The birthright of his dead brother would pass not to Onan, but to the baby whom he sired with his brother's widow, and the bawling little bastard would grow up to regard his own real father as a mere servant.
"Damn," Onan said out loud.
"Master," called Tamar. If she feared him, she did not show it. "What do you want?" "Come to me now," Tamar said sweetly, "and I will help you." Onan stared at her in the half-light of summer twilight, and he noticed that Tamar had removed her veil and her robes. He made out the shape of her breast, the curve of her hip, the slender legs. At last he approached, crouched at her side, and reached out to touch her. Tamar said nothing.
She tried to anticipate what her brother-in-law desired of her, but Onan pushed her delicate hand aside and handled her crudely and brusquely, almost in anger. Onan poked and probed Tamar's body with a kind of brutal curiosity, and then, quite to Tamar's amazement, he reached under his cloak and fingered himself urgently. Onan saw the look of astonishment on her face. "If you want me to do my duty," he admonished her, "then leave me be." A moment later, "Enough! On your back! Let me..." Tamar shivered ever so slightly as he entered her, a spasm of tension rather than pleasure, and she felt breathless under the dead weight of his body. But she encouraged him with a tender hand at the back of his neck and the same sweet words that she had once whispered into his brother's ears. Tamar consoled herself with the single thought that she held with perfect clarity, even as Onan labored over her. A son would restore Tamar to her rightful standing in the compound of the Israelites. A son of her own would ensure her a place in Judah's house, a seat at his table, an opportunity to survive and even to prosper. A son, she told herself, was life itself. Onan was nearly breathless with pleasure, but he cautioned himself against yielding to the impulse to spend himself between Tamar's legs. "Ah," he began to groan. "Ah, ah." "Yes, yes, yes," coaxed Tamar. Summoned away from her body by the cawing of his mind, Onan drew back and pulled himself out. Then, in a terrible moment that caught both of them by surprise, he spent himself in three shuddering spasms and spilled his seed on the floor of the tent in an arc of wasted passion. "No!" shouted Tamar as she grasped what he had done, but it was too late. She began to weep, and her tears were hot and angry. "You pig!" Onan, flushed red with shame, could think of nothing else to do but slap her across the face to silence her. But the weak, glancing blow stopped only her tears, not her words. "You pig," she repeated. Tamar rose, gathering her robe around her waist to cover her nakedness, and backed away from him. She dressed hastily in a dark corner of the tent as Onan watched. At last he got up, walked to the opening of the tent, then paused at the threshold and stared out into the compound. "Whore," he spat out, although Tamar was already too far off to hear him. As if Tamar had wished it upon him, a fever seized Omar the very next day and did not let him go. The compound fell into that strange silence that always marked the onset of illness. Was it the plague? Who else would fall ill and die? And exactly what offerings and sacrifices were necessary in order to preserve the health of the others? Even the children seemed to disappear into the tents and the houses around the compound, as if to avoid disturbing the ailing young man with the sound of play. And Judah himself was not to be seen for 7 days. At last, the word was passed from Judah's house. Onan, too, was dead. Now the whispers that spread from tent to tent were more pointed. The hand of the God of Israel, the deity that the Israelites knew as Yahweh, had struck down 2 of Judah's sons. What evil had Onan done that the vengeful God of the Israelites would take his life? And did Tamar play a role in the death of the 2 men who went to her bed? Judah summoned Tamar into his house a second time. The elders of the clan were there, but so was Hira. Judah spoke quietly. The house of Judah again would do its duty to Tamar. Shelah, the youngest son, would be sent to her tent as soon as he was deemed old enough. Until then, she would return to her own village and wait. "Take her to her father," Judah instructed Hira. "And remind him," one of the old men added, "that she must live in a manner that is worthy of a woman who is both widowed and betrothed." Judah watched his old friend and his daughter-in-law stooped across the threshold of his house, and suddenly he was taken with a peculiar sensation. Their dialect, their manner of dress, their rites of worship, all of their Canaanite ways suddenly struck him as alien and mysterious and terribly dangerous. And Tamar, so fierce and so dark, struck him as a creature more nearly like a spider than a woman. Judah vowed to himself, God forbid that his third son, his last son, should fall into her tainted bed. Let her remain a widow in her father's house, he said to the graybeards, using the old phrases of the Hebrew tongue. Lest Shelah die like his brothers. A year passed, and Shelah's beard began to grow, or so Tamar learned from the gossip of the kinfolk who passed through her father's village. But she was not summoned to the compound of the Israelites. Every morning and every night she brushed out her long black hair as if to prepare herself for her betrothed. And then one day she noticed that a few strands of silver had appeared at her temples. On that day, Tamar vowed to wait no longer for what was owed to her, a son and a place in the house of Judah. Not long after, one of the men of her village who tended the flocks of the Israelites brought word that Judah's wife had been laid to rest. Bathsheba had given him no more children after Shelah, and more recently her belly had grown hard and round with some foul growth. She lingered a long while, then died at last, and Judah observed the Israelite ritual of mourning, even though Bathsheba had been a Canaanite like Tamar. And now that he is finished with one of our women, said the shepherd to Tamar's father, he is rushing off to Timnah with his good friend Hira to carouse with a few more. Tamar listened in silence to the coarse talk as she worked with needle and thread over a long blue cloak. Perhaps he will find another one, Tamar's father said, to become his wife. Oh, he will find plenty of women in Timnah, the shepherd said with a leer, but no wife. At Timnah, as Tamar knew, the shepherds and not a few of the rich landowners who hired them gathered with their flocks for the sheep shearing, and when the wool was gathered and the hard work was done, they fell into a celebration that lasted for days on end. The wine merchants and the whores were always there, too, and the men freely availed themselves of their goods and services. Hira, Tamar thought to herself, knew how to console the grief-stricken Judah in a livelier way than the sour old graybeards would have allowed. And when will you go back to the Hebrews? Tamar's father asked the shepherd. Not soon, the man said. Judah leaves for Timnah in 3 days, and he won't be back until the new moon. Until then, I will stay here and drink with my own people for a change. Tamar continued to slip the needle deftly through the thick blue fabric on her lap. As she worked, an intricate pattern appeared beneath her fingers in delicate silver thread, as if by magic. As Judah trudged along the road to Timnah with Hira at his side, he spotted a figure in the distance, a woman in a blue robe who leaned against an olive tree at the crossroads. The heat of the afternoon and the tedious rhythm of their footfalls had lulled him into a kind of half-sleep. Even Hira had fallen into silence as the sun rose directly overhead, and so the beguiling woman by the side of the road seemed to appear as if in a dream. Only when he approached the crossroads did Judah see that the figure was a slender young woman with long black hair, veiled like a married woman, but dressed like a common whore. As he drew closer still, Judah caught the scent of the woman, saw the strong muscles of her calf and thigh as she reclined in the shade of the tree, and imagined in his stupor that her dark eyes sparkled with a light of their own.
Hira, my good friend, I believe I'll rest my feet for a while, said Judah to his companion as they approached the fork in the road, and I will catch up with you later on.
We must keep going if we are to reach Timnah by nightfall, Hira scolded Judah gently. Then he caught the hungry look on Judah's face. He laughed out loud and slapped Judah on the back.
Be patient, my friend, said Hira. and you will soon be able to comfort yourself with 7 women at once." But Judah had already turned aside and was striding toward the veiled woman. Hira stopped, shrugged, and called out to Judah. "I will wait for you around the bend," Hira shouted. "Do not tarry too long." As Judah approached, the young woman remained frozen and silent, her arms wrapped around her knees and her head slightly inclined toward the ground. If she were not dressed like a common whore, Judah would have thought that she was terrified of the strange man who strode up to her so boldly. "Woman," Judah said gruffly, "let me lie with you." The young woman did not answer, and Judah wondered for a moment if he had been mistaken in taking her for a harlot. But now he felt a fluttery ache in the pit of his stomach, a vague but insistent hunger that he could not ignore. Of course she was a whore. The alluring garment that she wore, the scent of strong perfume that rose from her skin, and the pendant that hung between her breasts belonged to no decent woman. "Let me lie with you," Judah demanded again. When the young woman finally looked up at Judah's face, she spoke in a clear and certain voice. "What will you give me then?" she asked. "To lie with me?" Judah was surprised at her bluntness, and surprised, too, to realize that he was haggling with a whore like a coarse field hand. What would the graybeard say? And yet Judah felt almost giddy as he imagined the moment of pleasure that he knew he would not deny himself, no matter what price she asked. "A kid from my flock," he said. An extravagant offer, Judah thought to himself, since he knew that the price of a whore was no more than a loaf of bread or its equivalent in copper coins, but he wanted to impress the young woman with his wealth and generosity, even if she was only a common harlot. Judah calculated that the woman would be more ardent if she knew that he was a rich and powerful man. Anyway, it was Hira who carried his purse on the road to Timnah, and Judah had no coins to give her. "And where is the little beast?" she demanded. Her voice was bolder now, more commanding, as she sensed how urgently he desired to satisfy himself with her body. "I don't see it." "Do you take me for a herdsman?" he asked, irritated and impatient. "I leave it to others to tend my flocks, but I will pick out a fat kid when I return to my house, and I will send it to you." "How do I know that you will not take your pleasure now," she taunted, "and then forget about me?" "What?" Judah asked, suddenly irritable. "Do you take me for a cheat?" Tamar studied Judah's face, his hooded brown eyes, his swarthy skin, his bristling black beard, and his fleshy cheeks now flushed red. She could see that he was angry, but so needful that she no longer doubted that she could get what she needed from him. "Give me a pledge until you send the kid," Tamar said playfully, "and I will give you what you want." "A pledge?" Judah was frankly baffled. "Are you jesting?" "Something of value," Tamar explained, moving her shoulders so that her breast swayed slightly under the fabric of her robe. "That I may keep until you send me what you have promised." The proposition was ludicrous, even laughable, but Judah did not laugh. "And what can I pledge?" he asked impatiently. "Give me your seal," Tamar said. Judah reached up and touched the cylinder of carved quartz that hung around his neck on a cord. "Your seal," she repeated. "And your staff, too. Give them to me as a pledge for the kid, and then I will spread my legs for you." If Judah had paused long enough to think about it, he would have realized how risky and foolhardy it would be to hand over his seal to a common whore. The tiny cylinder was the device that Judah used to imprint his name on the clay tablet and the papyrus scrolls that Hira sometimes prepared to confirm the purchase of a new plot of land or the sale of a season's harvest of wool.
It was the very symbol of identity and authority, and the long trek to Timnah and back would seem longer still without a walking staff. But Judah was thinking only of the scent that rose from the young woman's body. He was thinking only of the shadowy place between her legs as he stood over her in the heat and the dust. "Done," Judah said, letting the leather-laced walking staff fall to the ground next to the young woman. Then he pulled the cord over his head and cast it down at her feet. "Let's go, then." Tamar reached for the cord and held the seal in a closed fist. Then she rose to her feet and led Judah deeper into the olive grove on the hillside overlooking the crossroads. She reclined on the ground beneath one very old tree and drew up the hem of her robe to reveal her ankle, her knee, her thigh. And then she paused and waited. Judah, biting his lower lip and breathing hard through his nose, lowered himself to the hard-packed soil. He reached out to touch her so tentatively that Tamar wondered for one anxious moment if Judah knew perfectly well that she was no harlot. "Master," she cried out when she felt his fingers on her flesh. Her purpose had nothing to do with getting pleasure, but she was suddenly aware of a strange hunger of her own. "Oh, Master." Judah touched her with a tenderness that took her by surprise. As she yielded to his insistent caresses, Tamar thought to herself, "Sorry that the sons did not learn what the father clearly knows." "Are you ready now, Master?" she whispered at last. He lowered himself over her body and began to probe with short, strong, rhythmic motions, once, twice, three times, on and on. And then, as she responded to him with equal urgency, her veil fell aside and her face was revealed. Would he recognize her now? Tamar wondered. Would he draw back, or, as Tamar imagined in a kind of wild reverie, would he persist even though he recognized her, and would he persist with even greater fervor because he recognized her? And when they had spent themselves in each other's arms, after he rolled to the earth next to her, and Tamar hastily fixed the veil across her face once again, her thoughts took wing like prayers. "Take hold," she instructed the seed that was about to plant itself within her womb. Judah lay beside her for another long moment, cradling her briefly with one strong arm. Then he rose to his feet and looked back down at her. "My seal and my staff," he mused aloud. "I will be taken for a beggar on the road." "Then you must send me a kid as you promised," she said, "and be sure it is a healthy and strong one." Tamar reclined against the trunk of the ancient tree and watched as Judah hurried away, walking upright because he had no staff on which to lean. And she folded her arms on her belly. Judah returned from Timnah in high spirits. The flock had flourished, yield of wool was plentiful and of good quality, and Hira had led him down the alleys and lanes of lantern-lit tents to sample the strongest red wine, the fattest cuts of mutton, and the most willing women. And now Judah could be seen striding with such a quick step through the compound that the graybeards could not keep up with him. "He mourns no longer," said one of the Canaanites who served Judah at table. Still, Judah had not forgotten the young woman at the crossroads, and he began to afflict himself with the thought that she might appear at the door of his house to demand what she was owed. What a scandal she would make, not only among the chattering women in the compound, but especially among the old graybeards. Knowing that it would cost him little to honor his pledge, he summoned Hira to his chamber. "You remember the woman at the crossroads near Enaim?" Judah asked in a low voice. "The whore to whom you gave your staff and your seal," Hira taunted. "Yes, friend, I have not forgotten what a foolish old goat you have become." She was not a common whore, Judah protested. She was a temple prostitute. Hira laughed out loud. What do you know of temple women, my Hebrew friend? And did you make an offering to Baal before you worshipped between her legs? No, Judah ben Jacob, make no mistake. She was a whore, and that's all. Only now it is the whore who keeps your signet. Listen now, and do what I say, Judah said earnestly. Take a kid from the flock, pick one with some meat on the bones, then take it to the harlot at Enaim, and bring back my seal and my staff. Of course, Hira smirked. I will send one of my men. No, Judah said. I want you to go, old friend. Me? Hira was astounded. You expect me to go in search of some whore with a kid on my back? Your men would make light of the whole business, Judah complained. And soon the women's tent would be buzzing. I need you to go. Do you understand? Hira nodded and grinned. The sly twist of his mouth told Judah that he understood all too well. Toward sunset, on the second day after Hera's departure, Judah heard the commotion that always attended the arrival of a visitor to the compound. Judah cautioned himself against hurrying from the house to meet Hera, and he waited instead by the threshold. Even from a distance, Judah saw that Hera carried something around his neck, like a dark shawl. To his disappointment, he saw that it was the same kid that Hira had selected from the flock to redeem Judah's pledge. Why do you return with that, he demanded, instead of my seal and my staff? I asked after the woman at Enaim, but I could not find her. Whom did you ask? Who else would know the whereabouts of a temple prostitute, Hira taunted. The men of Enaim, of course. I asked where I might find the temple prostitute who sits by the fork in the road, and they said, there is no temple prostitute here. Judah's throat closed. Of course, he knew perfectly well that the woman who held his seal and his staff as a pledge was a common whore, not a temple prostitute. And he worried that Hira had asked after the wrong woman. But what if the woman, Judah ventured, was not actually a temple prostitute? Hira laughed out loud. So, you admit it then? Curse you, Hira, Judah muttered, to jest with me about something like this. Do not worry, friend, Hira said. The woman, whether she is a temple prostitute or a common whore, is long gone, and your seal and your staff are gone with her. Forget about them. It was, Judah said, a matter of honor. You have honored your word, haven't you? Judah allowed himself to be consoled. You're right, he said. I sent the kid, and what more can I do? Let her keep the pledge then, and no one can say that I do not keep my word. Now you must give me something to drink, Hira complained, or I will have a few stories of my own to tell. Judah led his friend into the house and waved over one of the servants. Good riddance to the whore, he thought. Tomorrow he would ask Hira to arrange for the artisans in the village to fashion him a new seal and a new staff. And what if it cost him more than the price of the kid to replace the missing pledge? The fact was that the harlot was gone, and along with her the prospect of scandal in the house of Judah. Now and then Judah thought of the harlot by the side of the road, but mostly he attended to the flocks and the crops, the petitions of his beseeching cousins, the repair of his houses and walls. Only Hira knew what had happened at the crossroads, Judah kept telling himself, and his secret was safe with his old friend. And since no one dared speak of the incident in Judah's presence, he did not suspect that the compound and the women's tent had fairly hummed with speculation for at least a week after Hira returned with a kid over his shoulder. Eventually, the whispered stories of what had prompted Judah to send Hira to Enaim in the first place were replaced by a new and much more urgent scandal. One of the old women had trekked to the village of Tamar's father for a wedding, and she returned to Judah's compound with the most remarkable news. Tamar was carrying a child.
Young Sheila must have slipped into her bed, she cackled as the rest tittered, and done his duty after all. Of course, it could not have been Sheila. No one had ever told him of Judah's vow, and truth be told, Judah was still fearful of the warning that could be heard in the crude jokes that his cronies uttered to each other when Tamar's name was mentioned. "She's killed off two of Judah's sons," they would say to each other. "Why risk the last one?" Word of Tamar's predicament finally reached Judah in the form of a whispered denunciation by the mother of a young woman who fancied Sheila for her own son-in-law. "Tamar has played the harlot in her own father's house," she whispered to one of the graybeards. "And now she carries someone's bastard in her belly." "And what am I to do about it?" Judah complained when the story was repeated to him. "Burn her," said one of the old men. "That's what the law decrees for adulteresses." "You want me to put Tamar to the fire?" Judah asked. "Are you serious?" "The law decrees," the old man began. "Let the woman be," Judah said, almost pleading. Judah found himself repulsed at the prospect of putting her lovely young flesh to the flames, and as Judah now realized, no one would expect him to send Sheila to her bed any longer. "Let her stay in her father's house," he concluded, "and raise the bastard." "Bring her out so she may be burned," one of the old men threatened, "or else you will be laughed at." Judah understood that a threat to his authority could not be safely ignored. What's more, he did not relish the thought of the gossip that would persist for as long as Tamar and her bastard lived in the nearby village. "All right, then," Judah relented. "Summon her to my house." So it happened that Tamar was brought from her father's house and escorted to Judah's compound by the elders and a half-dozen young men whom they had pressed into service. Everyone along the way could see that the story was plainly true. Tamar's belly was big, and she carried low. A son, to be sure. But whose son? Tamar was accompanied by her mother, who walked at her side, keening and moaning without pause, and one or two of her menfolk, who had been permitted to come along on the condition that they left their staffs and swords behind. Her father, or so it was whispered among the Israelites, had refused to enter the compound of the Israelites and submit to the indignity of a trial before Judah. The old woman hung her head as they walked through the compound, but the shrill noise she made carried all the way to Judah's door. The men from Tamar's village cast cautious glances to the left and right as they passed the gauntlet of Israelites who had gathered to see the scandalous sight of Tamar, pregnant and doomed. But Tamar, wearing the black robes of mourning, held her head upright and stared straight ahead. Chill winter wind swept the robe around her ankles, but she did not shiver or comfort herself with folded arms. At last, the procession entered the courtyard before Judah's house, and Tamar was left under guard outside the door, while the elders pushed into the room where Judah awaited them on a chair with armrests and a high back. One old woman, then a few younger men, and finally a small crowd of onlookers pushed into the room after them, and the graybeards did nothing to discourage them. An audience, they felt, would force Judah's hand if he showed signs of timidity. "The harlot stands outside," one of the old men said, "and the evidence of her adultery is plain to see." "What will you do?" another one demanded, and Judah heard a few murmurs and titters from the crowd that surged around him. "What does Tamar say?" Judah asked. The elder snorted. "She says nothing," he said, "because there is nothing to say. So burn her." Though it was chilly inside the house, Judah suddenly felt slightly feverish. A fine sweat appeared on his brow, and his skin prickled beneath his woolen robe. With a quick swipe of his right hand, he brushed the sweat from his forehead, then wiped his hand on his sleeve. "Say the words," one of the old men encouraged in a low whisper.
The law decrees it.
At that moment, there was a commotion at the back of the room, and the crowd parted slightly to reveal the figure of Tamar's mother and one of the menfolk from her village. The mother, casting her eyes down and wearing a look of misery and confusion, stumbled forward. Behind her, a young man held a bundle in his outstretched arms, but Judah could not see what was wrapped in the bulky gray blankets.
"Go away, woman,"
one of the elders hissed.
"You have no business here."
Judah raised one hand to silence the old man, and he did the same to the crowd with a single black look. The Canaanite woman took three more steps in utter silence, and then fell to her knees, pressing her forehead to the floor. The young man carefully lowered the bundle to the floor in front of Judah's chair, and he too fell to his knees.
"I beg you to listen, master,"
the old woman cried out in a desperate screech.
"Yes?"
Judah encouraged her. "What do you want to say?"
"My daughter sends me with a message."
"Go on." The old woman raised her head slightly but stayed on her knees.
"Tamar bids me say these words to you. The father of my child is the man to whom these things belong."
And then Judah rose from his chair and knelt in front of the old woman. He reached out and drew open the folds of the woolen blanket to reveal a cylinder of carved quartz on a length of worn rawhide and a leather-wrapped walking staff. For one crazy moment, Judah wondered exactly how the old woman had gotten her hands on the pledge that he had given the harlot by the side of the road. And then, a moment later, he understood.
"Whose seal is it?" demanded one of the graybeards. "Whose seal? Whose staff?" "Tell us," called a harsh woman's voice from the crowd, "and he'll burn too."
The old woman did not speak, and it was Judah's voice that was heard in the cold room. "No one will burn today," he said, amazing himself no less than the others. "Tamar is right, and I am wrong. I should have sent Sheila to her bed." The room fell silent, and even the querulous old men waited to hear Judah's words. "The seal and the staff are mine," Judah said. "And so is the child."
The narrator of Genesis 38, or more likely some pious editor who came along later and tried to cool down and clean up the story, hastens to reassure us that Judah did not sleep with his daughter-in-law a second time, and he knew her again no more, Genesis 38:26. But Tamar does not disappear from the biblical narrative. Rather, she gives birth to twin boys, Perez and Zerah. And the Bible carefully notes that Perez is the progenitor of a long line of celebrated figures, including David, Solomon, and according to the New Testament, Jesus of Nazareth. The willful young woman who plays the harlot in order to seduce her own father-in-law is the great-great-grandmother of kings, prophets, and the Christian Messiah. Still, the figure of Tamar, a Canaanite, a seducer and sexual trickster, a young woman who refuses to submit to the authority of the stern patriarchy under which she lives, has been nearly written out of the biblical tradition over the centuries, precisely because her sexual adventure on the road to Innium is so audacious, provocative, and titillating. The story of Tamar may trouble contemporary readers who are uncomfortable with a heroine whose weapon of choice is her own sexuality, whether because they are put off by the lurid roadside coupling, or because they are offended by the depiction of Tamar as a seducer who tricks a powerful man into giving her children. To some, the tale is scandalous because it is so sexually explicit. To others, it is sexist. Yet if we understand what is actually at stake for Tamar when she entices Judah to make love to her, the story takes on both heightened drama and urgent meaning. Tamar must conceive a male child, and she will go to the extremes of seduction in the guise of a whore to do it. Why is Tamar so desperate? And why are Judah and the rest of his clan so tolerant of her act of incest and seduction? The answer lies in the plight of women in biblical times. A woman was defined by her ability to produce children, and a childless woman was seen as someone cursed by God. Over and over again in the Bible, we encounter women for whom childlessness was a matter of life and death. The matriarchs of the Israelites, Rebekah, Sarah, and Rachel, are only the most prominent examples. "Give me children," cries Rachel to Jacob, "or else I die." Genesis 30, verse 1. The urgency is explained by the fact that a woman's identity, her social status, and even her livelihood were utterly dependent on the men to whom she was related. First her father, then her husband, and later her sons. So Tamar's sexual ambush of Judah on the road to Timnah was the act of a courageous and resourceful woman who refused to accept passively the fate that the patriarchy of ancient Israel decreed for a childless widow. She was not merely a seducer who tricked her father-in-law into giving her children by playing the harlot. Rather, she was a woman who stood up for her legal rights in the only manner available to a woman of her time and place. That Tamar is a Canaanite may have been even more embarrassing to the rabbinical authorities than the fact that Judah sleeps with her and fathers a pair of sons by her. One of the great themes of the Hebrew Bible, as we've already seen, is the outright condemnation of marriage outside the 12 tribes of Israel, and the Canaanites are the most strictly forbidden of all prospective lovers and spouses. "Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter shalt thou not give unto his son, nor his daughter take unto thy son." Deuteronomy 7, 3. The fear and hatred with which the Canaanites are regarded throughout the Bible leads us to another of its awkward and mostly overlooked features. We are told in the book of Genesis that Canaan is promised by God to Abraham and his descendants. But we discover in the book of Exodus that Canaan is not an empty paradise flowing with milk and honey. When the Israelites, after fleeing Egypt and spending 40 hard years in the wilderness under the troubled leadership of Moses, finally cross the River Jordan into the Promised Land, the place is teeming with tribes and clans that lived there long before the Exodus. The Hittite, the Amorite, and the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, among others. Joshua 12, verse 7. God's solution is to declare a war of conquest. We might easily use the term ethnic cleansing, or even genocide, against the native dwellers of the Promised Land. The slaughter of the Midianites that we discover in the book of Numbers is only an augury of the bloodthirsty campaign in Canaan itself. Thus, the story of Tamar and Judah suggests an urgent and crucial truth that has never been more pertinent than it is now. God instructed the Israelites to drive out and kill the Canaanites, but the Israelites were forced by the circumstances of history to live side by side with them. Today, the struggle of the Arab and Jew to find a way to live with one another on the same bloody ground where Judah and Tamar first met is no less momentous than it was 3,000 years ago. To be sure, the Bible offers abundant and bloody examples of war and terror practiced on each other by Israelite and non-Israelite. But the story of Tamar, like other shining examples in the Bible, suggests that these ancient enemies did and can find a way to live in peace with one another.